This is episode 7 of season 5 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu and this is my August cast about Linux and the GNU operating system and technical topics and Unix and Unix-like systems. First of all, I'm recording this episode at work, so if you hear a whole bunch of noise in the background, then you're probably hearing the jet engine-like fans of servers, so just ignore them, pretend like they're not there, or bask in them, and imagine you're here with me in the server room, comfortable, but a little bit chilly. So today we're going to talk about a little bit of Unix stuff with a capital U, but first let's start with, well, another Unix with a capital U. First, I wanted to talk about this recent webcam scandal that's been sort of making the rounds in the podcasting shows that I've at least heard, like Linux Outlaws, I think, talked about this. Linux Cranks, I think, may have talked about this. I don't really remember. Off the Hook talked about this. So apparently what happened was that some school district over on the east coast of the U.S. gave out laptops, apparently MacBooks, to students. And there's a built-in webcam on those, and the district apparently used those webcams to actively spy on the students to whom they'd given the MacBooks. I don't think it's really necessary to comment on this activity. I mean, I think we're all going to probably agree that it's almost so bad as to be almost unbelievable. But what I did want to talk about was kind of what it made me think about. But first and foremost, I'm going to play a clip from season, I think, 1 of this very show, wherein Gort actually talks about this exact same subject. This is like 2 years ago. We had a segment on basically preventing this from happening, so I'm going to play that right now.
Hey, do you remember that scene in 2001 where Bowman and Poole seal themselves in the escape pod and start talking about their concerns about the HAL 9000? And it turns out that HAL is actually watching them and reading their lips. Well, did you ever look at your MacBook's eyesight camera and get a funny feeling about it? Well, you know, the camera is an input device, and as far as I can find, there isn't an off switch for it. Sure, you could put something over it, like your thumb, or a piece of tape, if you wanted, but, you know, what about parents who want to make sure that their children aren't on iChat with people whose intentions are probably less than pure? My point is, you know, you at least need to know how the camera works and how it's controlled in order for you to be smarter than it. So, actually, it's pretty simple. You can turn it off. There's a component that enables QuickTime. It handles all of the video for Mac OS. Digitizes the camera's input also. So we find that component, move it out of its default location, and the camera is disabled. So here's how to find the component. Go to your hard drive. So that's outside of your user folder. Just your plain old hard drive. Your root folder if you're a Unix geek. Now move to your library. Go to the QuickTime folder and look for the file named QuickTime USB VDC Digitizer.component. It's only on Intel Macs with the built-in iSight. There may be a component installed with external iSights too, but you know that's an easy fix. You just unplug it. But back to our QuickTime component. So if you move this file into another folder somewhere, the iSight won't be able to utilize it. Can't find it. It's not there. It only looks in one place for it. Ain't there? Doesn't use it. So for maximum security, you may want to zip it up into some other name, an archive file, and put it somewhere that you remember. And actually, that's your department, I think, more than mine.
Well, sure. I mean, I think what you did was fine, too. But, I mean, if you want to do what you just did in the terminal, you would type in cd, that's change directory, space, /system/library/quicktime, that's capital letters at the front of each of those words. You'd hit return, and then you'd say ls, so that lists all of the things in the folder. You would see the QuickTime USB, I'm seeing it here, VDC digitizer.component. So what you would do is sudo, sudo, space MV, that's for move, MV space / disabled. Disabled, you can call it anything.
Now, to re-enable the iSight, all you've got to do is grab that file from wherever you stashed it, put it back into the system library QuickTime folder, and you're back in business.
All right, so that was my old co-host, Gort, who, of course, has been banned from the show since he doesn't really use Linux all that much. But to be fair, he was using Linux before me back in the day, so, and running it on servers, I think, so I'm glad to have replayed his old segment on avoiding unexpected webcam activity. Now, the thing that this whole story and this whole mess kind of made me think of was that free software has this hard to quantify, but it does seem to be very strong sense of encouraging users to investigate things and to not be complacent with much of their system at all. So specifically speaking of the GNU Linux operating system, we have lots of different, well, everything's open, first of all. And of course, the first response to that, you know, to the sort of argument that, hey, if it was open, you know, completely open and free software, people could have looked at the code and they would have seen the super secret webcam spy subroutine and they would have not used it or something. The argument to that would be, well, chances of all the students being given a laptop doing that are slim to none. And that's true. Ideally, someone would have looked at it and someone would have seen it and would have reported it to everyone else. That would be really great if that had happened. But taking it even one step back from that, like taking it to a less technical level, I think that free software seems to kind of say to the users, don't just take the disk, install it, and go. Take it, install it, play around with it, find out how it works, learn about the computer, learn about what it's doing and how it's doing what it does, and from there, go on your way. Not on blind faith, just as a consumer who will just consume anything handed to them, but as someone who will look at what they're being given and kind of exploring it and finding out how it all works and watching it and seeing what exactly is going on in the computer. This, I think, is a powerful point because it does fly in the face of the current model of how things are delivered to us, whether it's the media that we entertain ourselves with, movies, music, writing, all that good stuff. Do you simply take the mediocre stuff that the established companies are trying to feed us and making us pay for and then persecuting us if we quote-unquote pirate them? Or are we maybe looking elsewhere for our entertainment, stuff that has Creative Commons associated with it, stuff that is more original, something, you know, stuff that's more personal, a little closer to home maybe, whatever. The same goes for the computer. You know, are you just taking this mediocre operating system that companies are trying to force onto your computer, settling for it, and just trusting that it's all okay, and that there's going to be support for it later on, and all this other good stuff? You know, there's that mentality of just not questioning anything, that's just, you're just taking whatever's handed to you, versus the free software mentality, which seems to me to be more like, take it and look at it and ask questions about it, find out more about it, learn about it. And if you think about it, it only takes one time for you as a GNU Linux user to sit down and at the command line run the insert mod the insert mod command, or, you know, mod probe, sudo mod probe, whatever, or whatever variety of that command you're running. It takes you one time to run that, and then your world kind of opens up, or at least mine did, and you realize that, oh, there's this kernel, and if I plug in a new hardware device, the kernel needs to know how to talk to that hardware, and if it doesn't have a module available to do that, then there's not going to be any communication between the computer and that hardware device. I get it now. I understand how this sort of thing works. And if you understand that, it's not far to make that leap over into, for instance, OS X, where, well, you realize there's a Darwin kernel, and you know that there are these files, and if you take a file from the system library and place it somewhere else on the system, then that webcam is not going to turn on. It's not going to turn on no matter what spyware software they've got on that box. It's just not going to happen. And even maybe even more basic than that, just understanding the whole structure of what a root user is and how users are created and what permissions the users have and all that other good stuff. It's something that has been abstracted away from the Unix flavor that OS X is so far that no user of OS X, well, I wouldn't say no user, but most typical users of OS X, they don't even understand what they're doing. All they know is that the computer's asking them for a name and a, quote, short name. No clue as to what any of that stuff means, the significance of it, why when they take a file from one computer to another, they sometimes have permission issues and errors, and yet they might even own the computer. It might even be the same computer after, like, some kind of recovery or something. They just don't understand this stuff, much less do they understand that there might be software on there spying on them, or how they could prevent that from happening if they just understood a little bit about the computer. So I guess it's just a feeling that I have, and like I say, it is unquantifiable. You can't really say that, look, oh, free software creates smarter users, because that's not necessarily true. You could be a dumb free software user just as easily as you'd be a dumb proprietary software user. You don't have to investigate, you don't have to explore, you don't have to seek knowledge or understand. You can just live in happy, friendly Linux distro land, you know, whether it's Ubuntu or Mandriva or Fedora or even Slackware that someone else set up for you, and never know anything about any of that stuff. But I think that the spirit of free software, the encouragement to hack on it, the encouragement to open it up and look at it and find out what makes it tick and change it, theme it. You know, just last night on Kernel Panic Ogcast, which is sort of Linux Crank's twin or evil twin or something, we were talking about the desktop on Linux and how most users of a GNU Linux system don't settle for the default desktop, so it almost doesn't even matter what the default desktop is, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. There are just so many variations that people do to their GNU Linux system, and it's really expected, you know, it's not uncommon. Whereas if you sit in front of someone's Windows or OS X box and they have it all themed and modded and hacked and stuff, that's a really unique kind of system, and you take notice of it. But on GNU Linux, I mean, you see that and you're just like, yeah, figures. So I think that's important. That's what I'm trying to say. I think that it's important for there to be that spirit, because otherwise we are just blind consumers who aren't really paying attention to anything, and in the meantime our freedom or our solidarity or our privacy or whatever is just kind of being swept under the rug, I guess. So just my thoughts on the webcam scandal, I guess. And I think that free software and the desire to know more about it is a good model, and I think proprietary software, where they don't want you to know any more about it because they're afraid of you reverse engineering it or something like that. I mean, they don't just not encourage hacking on things. They actively discourage it, and they actively try to thwart your attempt to do so. So there's no wonder that people aren't poking around on these systems and trying to understand why the webcam ever turns on at all, whether they want it to or not. Yes, free software, very important. So for quite some time, actually, I think for as long as I've had this show, actually, I've maintained sometimes secret, sometimes not so secret blogs, or sometimes it's been a wiki, you know, just different things where I can put things online so that the only place that all this information is going is not just into an audio podcast, which obviously is not compute machine readable or necessarily very handy for the human who wants to reference it frequently during a task or something like that. So, or republishing or redistributing, whatever. So I like to get a lot of the stuff that I say out in some kind of written form. And some people do this with very long and elaborate show notes, but I can't be bothered. I sort of like the whole blog post kind of thing. Or a wiki would do, too. But anyway, my point being that I've got a blog right now, and it's called a not blog, because I don't like blogs, actually, but I do like the fact that you can put information online. And I got interested in this whole Linux Planet thing, which is a blog aggregator for Linux blogs. So if you go to linuxplanet.org, you'll find all kinds of interesting and cool blog postings from all different Linux users. And for whatever reason, I said, yeah, go ahead and throw mine up there. Just put my RSS feed up there. Bad idea, because now all the stuff that I do in preparation for my show comes out on the Linux Planet before I get to do the show about it. So it's basically a huge spoiler. which isn't a bad thing, but I'm afraid... It's not a bad thing for me, I couldn't care less, but I'm afraid of boring you, my dear listener, who might think, why is he talking about this right now? I just read the whole article on his blog. It's very clear and obvious. Why do I need to hear this again? So if you're someone who's been following my blog, I apologize for this episode and for probably the next episode, because they're actually basically information that I also posted on my blog. Hopefully, ideally, you're not a blog reader. You have no idea what I'm talking about, and you're like, oh, wow, he has a blog? My point is that I'm probably going to move my blog, because I don't really care for it being out there the way that it is. But I'm going to also, the information will still be online. I'm just going to move it so that, that I can post things and not really post them, kind of save them as drafts and stuff like that, which I could do now, but I never remember. Anyway, there's going to be changes in the whole not blog world, so get ready for that, and you probably won't notice. You just won't see new posts by me on Linux Planet, basically. But yeah, so I do apologize for any information that I'm repeating, but sometimes it is better to hear it, sometimes it's better to read it, sometimes it's better to have both, so I don't feel that bad about talking about this, but... Yes, I'm aware of the problem. It is being fixed. Unix with a capital U, huh? Well, what could I be talking about? As we all probably know, Unix, the term, or the word, I guess, the acronym, really, was a trademark or a brand name or something of Bell Labs back in the 60s or 70s or something, and they famously gave it away to one group and sold it to another group, and then no one knows where it went from there. But it is widely recognized, and I guess it's sort of a fact, as much as there seems to be anything factual about the history of Unix, the trademark. It is a fact, apparently, that Solaris, Sun Microsystems, created a Unix with a capital U, a proper, AT&T derivative, when they made Solaris. So that's interesting, and if you've heard my show for any amount of time, you probably know by now that I've tried out OpenSolaris on two separate occasions. I guess just to see what a big commercial Unix was like, felt like in comparison to that little hobbyist project, GNU Linux. And at least from my perspective, which isn't worth a whole lot since I'm not a guy in the big data farm doing all kinds of cool Unix-y things, they were pretty much exactly the same. Except that on the GNU Linux box, you use GNU tools and some BSD tools, and you have a really great license, like the GPL. And on the Sun Microsystems, Solaris, or Open Solaris as the case may be, you've got Sun tools. So basically, they look and feel and just like the GNU tools, but the code itself was written by Sun Microsystems people. So you got Sun tools and a non-GPL compatible license. Well, that's neither here nor there for what I'm going to be talking about, but it's just, there you go, that's some information for you. What I'm going to be talking about is the fact that I did play around with OpenSolaris about two separate occasions, and at Southeast Linux Fest last year, I picked up a free OpenSolaris t-shirt, which now is probably a collector's item or some such thing as that, since there is no more Sun Microsystems. So I wore this OpenSolaris shirt, this t-shirt, into one of my jobs, one of the more technical jobs that I have right now, and no sooner do I walk in the door does everyone turn and look at my shirt, which says OpenSolaris on the front, and they say, oh, you're going to beta test the new software that we're writing for Solaris. Why? Because I was the only one who's apparently used Solaris. Obviously the developers, I'm sure, could do all kinds of cool things with Solaris, but they needed someone, a non-developer, a user, a dumb user, who was familiar with the system, but could also beta test the software that they were writing. I mean, again, I'm not saying that I was literally the only one to have used Solaris. I'm sure other people in the organization have, but they're all much higher in rank than I, and they're not going to sit around and beta test the software. So what I'm trying to say is that I was the schmuck who wore the OpenSolaris shirt in, and so I got the extra job of beta testing this software. And everyone else was smart and said, Solaris, what's that? Is that like Windows? So I was actually okay with it. I was quite happy with it, really, because Why not? It sounds interesting. And I've done a little bit of QA testing in the past. So I sat down, and they gave me the SSH. They gave me SSH access to the Solaris server itself, Solaris 10, on a server that's relegated to a lonely corner in the server room now, I'm sure. And then they threw a 2009.6 Open Solaris image on a computer. This is in addition to my Ubuntu desktop. So I use Ubuntu on this job normally, and then not far away there's my Ubuntu, my Open Solaris workstation. So I had this whole Solaris stack now, and I decided to sit down and take the day and kind of play around with it, because why not? I mean, it's better than actually working, right? Just playing around with Unix all day. So I sat down and told everyone that I had to get Open Solaris, you know, ready for everyday use, and they believed me because no one knows anything about it. So I sat down and I knew from past experience that I should probably try to put BlastWave on it. And BlastWave is a community repository of software for Solaris and Open Solaris. And somehow on my way over to BlastWave's site, I got intercepted by Wikipedia, which was telling me that I could also check out OpenCSW, which is yet another community repository for Solaris. I liked the word open, so I decided to try that out first. OpenCSW, as it turns out, well, CSW, refers to community software, CSW. And it is opposed to the Sun packages, which are all labeled, like, if you look in a repository, you'll see a whole bunch of, like, Sun FUBAR, Sun FUBAR, Sun FUBAR. So you got, like, capital S, capital U, capital N, preceding all the package names. So if you want to do, like, a package util, or a package add, wget's already on there. Package add, well, let's just say wget. Package add wget, then you would have to put package add Sun wget in order to get the full package. So that's how they label them. Now, there's also a CSW variety where it'll say CSW wget, CSW links, CSW curl, you know, all these different CSW packages. Those are the two, I guess, forms of repositories, really. There's the Sun, and then there's the CSWs. And OpenCSW is simply a repository being maintained by some Solaris users so that they can get all the free applications that they like, or that they need, or that maybe they're used to using at home on their Linux box, or whatever, on their Solaris box. Now, interestingly, they don't officially support Open Solaris yet. I think they said, I chatted with them a little bit in their IRC channel, so, and they're a bunch of nice guys, and so I chatted with them, and I think they said, if memory serves, they said that they do plan on doing Open Solaris at some point, like making that officially supported, but right now, Solaris is what they officially support, and I ignored them and installed it on Open Solaris anyway. And so I wanted to talk about how to get that on to a Solaris, an Open Solaris box. It's quite easy, but it's something that you would need to know how to do if you're going to play around with it. So installing OpenCSW is a matter of first grabbing the utility package that OpenCSW uses, and that is called package util, PKGUTIL, package util. So you do a pfexec. Pfexec is the Solaris term, I guess, for sudo, or su-c, quote, foobar, quote. So you just do pfexec, pkgadd, dash d, and then the website of, or the location of this package util, which is http://mer.opencsw.org/opencsw/official/package-util-, except what's the one, it's right under the tilde, you know, it's like apostrophe, really. So apostrophe uname space dash p apostrophe dot pkg. And that will grab the correct version of package util for your system and install it. All of this stuff gets installed into /opt/CSW. So I don't know how often you've used /opt. I have used it a little bit on Slackware when you need to install the KDE3 libs in addition to KDE4. All the KDE3 stuff goes into /opt. And on Mac ports, back when I was using Macs, if you do Mac ports, which is sort of it's the porting of Unix apps over to Mac, it all goes into /opt. So I've used it a little bit. It's just a directory, but you know, if you're not used to seeing it around and going into it, it might throw you off a little bit. But just know that all the CSW stuff gets installed into /opt/CSW, which I like. I do like this opt convention. So you've just installed package util, and what it does is it installs package util itself, which is in /opt/CSW/bin, and then package util.conf, which is in /opt/CSW/etc. You should probably look at packageutil.conf in /opt/CSW/etc and see what mirror you're going to be using for all of your package needs in terms of OpenCSW. I changed mine to a mirror that I felt was more local to me than, I guess, the default California one or whatever was in there. I'm imagining it's California. I don't really remember. So I changed that, and they've got a list of their mirrors on their website. They have two branches as well. You can follow the stable branch or the current branch, the current obviously being the unstable branch. Since this was just, I mean, at any moment I could nuke this system and reinstall OpenSolaris, I didn't really care, so I went ahead and went with current. Most of what I'm going to be doing is actually on the Solaris box, so it won't actually matter all that much. But just be aware, obviously, that if you're mirroring a current, you're introducing yourself to a whole world of fun potential bugs and stuff like that, so don't do that on a production system or whatever. And I guess it's arguable whether you would want to actually run OpenSolaris on a production system anyway, but just be aware of that. So you've got this /opt/CSW/etc/packageutil.conf, and you've got that all configured. So now what you want to do is run /psexec/packageutil/-U, and that updates the repository catalog from that mirror that you've selected, or the default one if you didn't bother selecting anything at all. Okay, so before you go any further, we should do some security stuff. And this is good to do, because this ensures that you're actually getting the thing that you think you are getting. First, in order to do security stuff, you have to install GNU-PG, which is GPG. That would be /opt/CSW/bin/packageutil/i/GNU-PG. So the packageutil-i is install. The -i just means install. You can spell it out, if I recall correctly, with -- install or something like that. But obviously it's easier to just do -i. And the reason I'm putting the full path in is because we have not yet added the /opt/CSW/bin to our path. And don't do that yet, actually, because we're going to do that in a very specific way. So do not add that to your path yet. Just bear with me while we use the paths. Then you want to wget the OpenCSW GPG key and import it. So then you do a wget /temp/gbg.key/http://www.opencsw.org/mirrors #key/pound key, however you want to say the Octothorpe character. You do that, and it imports, or it grabs the key, and then you do /opt/CSW/bin/GPG /import/temp/GPG.key. And that's pretty standard stuff for GPG, right? You grab the key, and then you import it. Done deal. Well, almost done deal. Now you have to go back into /opt/CSW/etc/packageutil.conf and tell it to use GPG. And MD5. And the way that you tell it to do this is at the very bottom of the conf file, you'll see those two options commented out, so you just uncomment them and then save it. And of course you have to do that as root, because it's in /opt, so just pfexec vim that file, or Emacs or nano or whatever. So now you've got to get something called package get. And package get is basically, well, it is, I think, like apt-get is for apt. It's the front end to this whole packaging thing that actually deals with all the dependencies and stuff. So it's supposed to be really good. I do not believe it's a free software package, and I do believe that Open Solaris community is attempting or in the progress of coming up with a completely free and open version of package-get. The way to get package-get is you just do a pfexec /opt/CSW/bin/package util/install/package_get. This is weird, because the actual command is package-get, but to install that application, it is package_get. That took me like an hour to figure that discrepancy out. I kept trying to install package-get, couldn't do it. It's package_get. So again, if you want to edit the package-get.conf file, it's found in /csw/etc/package-git.conf, and you can define what mirror you want to look at and what branch you want to be on, and then save that. And now we can go ahead and add all these commands to our path. The way that OpenCSW advises you to do that is to add the location of these things at the very front of your path. So what you need to do is do an echo, quote, path, all in caps, equals, /opt/csw/bin:$path, all in capitals, close quote, redirect, or, you know, greater than, /bash/rc, and that will add the /opt/csw/bin to the beginning of your path. And that's what OpenCSW advises, so do that. And then, of course, you'll have to close that bash session and reload it, or, you know, get a new bash session open so that it's actually looking at your new path. And you can echo $path to make sure that it has that /opt/csw in front of it. You can test it out at this point as well by issuing the command /pfexec/package-get/U, and that will update the repository, and it'll make sure that it's really the repository, and you'll probably see a message about GNU-PG and all that other good stuff, so that should work. And that's it. That's how to get OpenCSW installed on your OpenSolaris box. There you go. That's what's going on. So hopefully the OpenSolaris project will continue to really, really grow and thrive, because and actually make things even more open. I mean, it's great to have the word open in front of your brand name or your trademark or whatever, but CDDL just doesn't strike me as that open per se, and I'm definitely not clear on the advantages of all that stuff. But I mean, it'd be cool. What would really been cool if Sun had, and I don't know the legalities of this kind of thing, probably it's not legal, but right before the deal was done between Oracle and Sun, if Sun had just like signed some paper that said everything we've ever done is now free software, you know, GPL, everything, like the Solaris kernel, the Java, just everything, that would have been pretty interesting. But I'm sure I'm sure there's clauses in all those wonderful legal documents that say you're not allowed to do stuff like that, but whatever. So as it happens, OpenCSW will actually allow you to install Fluxbox. They actually have a port of Fluxbox there, so that's really nice. You can do that with a pfexec /package-get/i/Fluxbox, and then in addition to Fluxbox, you'll want to do Image Magic, and you might as well do X Screensaver as well. Image Magic because it's a dependency of FB SetBG, and then X Screensaver because there's a cool trick that I'm about to reveal. It's kind of fun to do in Fluxbox. So once that's all installed, and it's going to ask you a lot of questions, like, are you sure you want to do this? Do you want to accept this? Do you want to install this? And you have to say yes. It's kind of bothersome. There's probably a, you know, answer yes to all flag, but I just haven't looked it up yet. But yeah, so Fluxbox will be there, and then you can always see a list of everything in the repository by doing a pfexec /package-get/a, and that lists all available packages. So you can do that and then grep what you want, or you can do that and redirect it to a text file. I redirected it to a text file and I kind of browsed through it or searched with less, that kind of thing. So you can do either one of those. Now, for whatever reason, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time on this because by this time I needed to kind of break away from just doing fun stuff and then had to really, you know, do stuff. So I couldn't get GDM to recognize that Fluxbox was on my system. I tried stupid tricks like doing a soft link from the opt directory /opt/csw/bin/fluxbox, putting a link to that over in just normal /user/bin or wherever GNOME is. That didn't do it. I couldn't figure out how to get GDM to let me sign into Fluxbox. So what I ultimately did was I just renamed GDM, which is a really bad hack, I'm sure. It's just /user/fbin/gdm/user/fbin/gdm-stop. So then you reboot the system, it's not going to find GDM, and so it's not going to be able to start GDM, so you'll just get dropped down to a text console. Before rebooting, I did an echo /exec/opt/csw/bin/fluxbox:\redirect\redirect /.xinitrc, which of course, ever since episode 0, that's pretty much been the same command I've used for my StartX stuff. So that's just saying in .xinitrc, put the line exec, whatever desktop you want to start running, in your home directory, and there you go. So now you can reboot, and if you reboot, yes, it does fail to reboot all the way, in a way, because it doesn't know where GDM is, so it kind of just dies, and it drops you down to a text login, which is frankly what I prefer anyway. So I mean, another option, I guess, would be some kind of, like, package uninstall or package remove, you know, GDM, and see if that works. But this is working for me right now, and I don't actually reboot this machine very often so far, so it's not really an issue. The Fluxbox that gets installed is very plain vanilla, which is nice, because then you can just build it up from there. So I really like that. I do like plain vanilla installs a lot. And one cool thing that I was doing, because I didn't have a screen image, an image that would fit the screen without a lot of, like, cropping and stuff, and I didn't have time to play around with that kind of stuff. So what I decided to do was put X Screensaver as my background, as my wallpaper. Yes, you can do this. This is a very cool trick. All you do is you go to, well, so we've already installed X Screensaver, so what you do would be you'd run /opt/csw/libexec/xscreensaver/foobar --root\ampersand. So the foobar would be replaced by some name of some screensaver animation that is in that folder, /opt/csw/libexec/xscreensaver. And if you do another tab, it'll say, you know, do you want to see all 158 options or, you know, listings? And you say yes, and then it shows you all 158 or whatever the number is of how many X screensaver animations there are. And there's, you know, Galaxy and Goop and Flurry and Cube and Cube 2 and all these different animations, so you can try different ones out and see what you like. But the point is that rather than a static image in your wallpaper on your background, it actually runs X Screensaver animation in the background. It's really kind of cool. I'm sure it's a complete waste of CPU and graphic and memory and everything in between, but I mean, it's just X Screensaver. I don't think it's really that big of a deal. So I did that, and it's fun. 205, actually. That's how many there are. So you could put that line into your startup file as well to make it do that every time you boot up. I didn't. I eventually got around to just replacing it with a static image. And otherwise, it's just, you know, OpenCSW has quite a few apps that they've ported over, so it's a really great way to get some of your favorite GNU utilities on your otherwise proprietary-ish Unix system. So, I mean, proprietary and yet open Unix system. So hope that helps someone, and if not, at least you heard how it's done, and now you know a little bit more about OpenSolaris.
This is coffee.
Listener feedback. Well, first of all, actually, there's listener feedback from myself. I emailed myself this article that I had stumbled across somehow. I don't really remember where I found this, but it's rwmj.wordpress.com, and there's an entry in there called "Why the Windows Registry Sucks Technically." This is a really fascinating article. I'll definitely have a show note link in the show notes about this, because it is fantastic. And I've said this before, and I've really meant it, I have no idea why I hate Windows. You know, I mean, Windows has never done anything to me before. It's never hurt me in any way, aside from the usual way of being inefficient and confusing for people and stuff like that, or where I have to help people with their Windows boxes, even though I've never used it before, you know, that kind of weird stuff. But, I mean, in terms of me sitting and wasting hours of my life because I don't, you know, because Windows is hindering me in some way, that's not really a big deal for me. But I do know from my training that Windows is bad. But rather than just sitting and saying, yes, Windows is bad, I'd like to kind of know why it was bad. Well, this article actually tells you why some very important components of Windows is very bad. This is literally just a technical, basically they were like kind of reverse engineering the registry to get some kind of plug-in. I think it's the name of the plugin has just slipped my mind, but it's in the article anyway. It's a way to read and modify the Windows registry from a Linux box. You know, it's kind of an application that can go in and kind of mess around with it. So it's obviously a useful tool. But in order to get that to work, they had to figure out the registry. So they know very, very well why the registry sucks. It kind of boils down to something like, it's not a database, it's actually a file system. That's really an interesting thing, and it's kind of more interesting to even hear that whether or not something is a file system is a debatable subject. You know, I mean, that's, like, you always thought there were certain absolutes in life, right? Well, apparently that's not one of them. File systems are a relative thing, so that's kind of interesting. But it's a fascinating article, and when I first started reading it, I got a little bit scared because I thought, okay, this is going to be way over my head. But he does a really good job of explaining things, and you should definitely check this article out. It's really, really good. As usual with blogs, the comment section is woefully useless and pointless. I don't know why people leave comments on their blogs other than, I guess, because just in case someone needs to contact you, it's kind of easy for them to comment. But, I mean, really, comments are just so ugly. They're horrible. They're just really, really bad. It's the worst thing about the internet. Certainly, at least one of the many worst things about Web 2.0. But, yeah, okay, so this is a good article. Check it out. And I will have the link in the show notes, I assure you, because it's a really impressive article. Deep Geek wrote me, and he said, okay, so Slackware has package management or whatever, but he's wondering about apt-get on Slackware. And this is, of course, embodied by slapt-get, which is Slackware apt-get, slapt-get. And that is a project that was started by somebody. I don't remember who. Well, that was a profound statement. It was started by somebody. It was started by some group. I thought it was, like, one of the distributions that were based on Slackware, but now that I'm thinking about it, I could be totally wrong. Point is, slapt-get is out there. I know Woolvix does have it available. The problem for me with slapt-get, and again, this is coming from a noob who understands nothing about this stuff. The problem is, where you're doing the whole package management thing, you can sit down and learn package management, or you can learn how to use the database that is the front. You can learn how to use the front end to the database that encompasses your system's package management. So, which of those two do you think I like better? Which one is the more direct route to the goal? Obviously, the one where you just figure out package management. You're the package manager. You figure out your dependent. You know, you read the README. You look and see what else you need on your system. As much as I love Yum and Apt and Aptitude and URPMI and all these other things, they strike me as a level of abstraction that I don't really understand the need for. I also don't understand the logic, I guess, behind saying, okay, we're going to take everything that was installed and we're going to keep track of it, and then you're going to hit this update button and it's going to go out and see what needs to be updated. It just, I mean, it is a monumental task. But I guess what I'm questioning is that how much of this stuff really needs to be updated on such a regular basis that we need to track it like that, I guess. Maybe there is a good reason. I'm sure there's a good reason. So would I use slapt-get? Nope. Secondly, he asks about Fluxbox. He says, surely there are some doc apps that you like to use with Fluxbox. And, you know, actually there aren't. There aren't any doc apps that I've never really been that big into, like, doc apps. But after he wrote me and asked about that while I was at work, I figured, you know, why not? I'm not going to litter my home system with these little things, but I'm going to do it here at work. Try them out. So I did. So I went to docapps.org, and I think that is doc-apps.org, and I checked out a couple of different applications, mostly his suggestions. WMND, that's a network monitor. I think he said Mixer. I just did WMIX, WMix, and that's a little audio mixer. WMAuda, A-U-D-A, that's a front end for, it's a doc app for Audacious, which is, I guess, sort of like XMMS2 or something like that. I don't really know the relationship, but it's a good little app. WM Bin Clock is my binary clock that I have on there. WM Weather is the weather applet, or the doc app, rather. And I think I have WMCPU load and WMMon, which is the memory monitor, and it tells you if you've got, you know, if you're using swap yet and stuff like that. And frankly, I love them. I mean, this is a big screen at work that I have, so I don't really, I don't feel cluttered, but I'm really enjoying them. So I'm glad that he asked me about that. They're well worth using. Frankly, they're a lot easier to install from the repository. So if you're on something with the repository, remember how I said I don't like those repositories? Well, sometimes I do, and this would be one case that I do. I tried to install, I tried to install a kind of a problem one, because after I tried to install and failed repeatedly. I went to the site and I did look at the comments, and it looks like a lot of people were having problems with this particular one that I was trying. But after that, I was so jaded that I just apt-get installed all the rest of the dock apps. So, oh well. So let's see. Blender 2.5 is out. Rain from France emailed me that. This was a funny email, actually, because I've actually been running Blender 2.5 on one of my machines for months now. So it's just kind of like, oh, the alpha's out? I kind of thought I was running the alpha or something, but of course I wasn't. But yeah, so 2.5 is pretty neat looking, and it's kind of exciting because it looks like they're favoring a little bit of more intuitiveness, a little bit more of, you know, it's a little bit more obvious as to what things are supposed to be doing and where things are. Things are less hidden, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Is it completely obvious and intuitive and stuff? Well, no. But is any 3D application? I kind of doubt it. And I have seen others. So yeah, 2.5 is pretty cool. Crane also sent me a Debian blog post, or, you know, something from Planet Debian, by a guy named Russell Coker. And he was talking about that, I don't know if you've seen those anti-piracy, unquote, campaigns in, like, theaters and stuff, and they say things like, you wouldn't steal a car, would you? You wouldn't steal a purse, would you? And then it says, so you shouldn't steal a movie. And he points out, this guy, Russell, points out in his blog post quite accurately that this is completely not correct. This is an inaccurate simile, because, or comparison, rather, because grabbing a movie is not stealing a car or a purse or anything like that. It's copyright infringement, perhaps, and that's about it. You're not reselling it, so there's not really anything like that. It's just going against the copyright. And he's trying to come up with some different analogies. That was the word I was looking for. Analogies, not simile. Analogy. Analogy for the act of copying a movie or an album, and comes up with some pretty interesting results. Now, I've talked about this myself in a previous episode. I recall quite clearly definitely saying that the word pirate is the completely wrong word to be using for this. And I'll say it again. Piracy is not copying a movie. Piracy is jumping from one ship to another and taking over that seafaring vessel. That is piracy. That's piracy. This is not. And then Ren also sent me something about Mego, which, of course, Mego, if you haven't heard by now, which, of course, you have, is the merger of Mamo and Moblin. Yeah, so Mego. I mean, it sounds bizarre to me because, I mean, I know that Mamo was going the cute route, and Moblin was solidly a GTK kind of thing, I thought, so they seem completely incompatible to me, but I didn't really love either enough to be sad that they merged. You know, I mean, Mamo was okay, but I didn't really, I mean, it was GTK based for the entire time that I've been using it, and I'm not crazy about it. I don't feel like they ever really got the interface perfectly down. I think I talked about this once, but I mean, little things like, you know, you open up a web browser and all your buttons are really, really big, and then you go to a page with a scroll bar, and the scroll bar is this little tiny little thing, and so you have to pull out the stylus just to use the little scroll bar. Whereas this whole time where you've been launching applications, you've been doing it fine with your finger. So it's kind of like, what are you guys going for? Are you going for touch screen with a finger? You're going with touch screen with a stylus? Or can you give me the choice? Can you say, okay, you do want to use your stylus or you don't want to use your stylus? We will give you the interface that provides for each one of those. I wasn't crazy about MAMO as much as, you know, as such. I was crazy about the fact that it was running Linux and that it was a fairly easy to hack version of Linux, but I wasn't really all that crazy about the interface itself. And as far as Moblin, I really wasn't crazy about it, but quite possibly maybe it'll be better for this kind of stuff, because they did seem to have a good handle on the interface. I didn't love the interface, but they did seem to have a good handle on the part of the interface that they were doing. Now, it started to break down once you started launching applications and they just kind of popped up in their own windows outside of this magical interface. I didn't really get the deal with that, but the overall look and feel of it, you could tell that they actually had a goal. They wanted to do the whole mobile device optimized interface thing, and so that could be a good thing. It'll be interesting. I mean, I don't know. I've heard some people talk about how it's sad, it's horrible that they did that, too bad, whatever. I don't really care. So, let's see, Sigflup wrote me. Now, Sigflup, I don't know if anyone else knows this, but she had an article in 2600 Magazine recently, which you should definitely check out. I don't think it's this past quarter's. I think it was the quarter before. I could be wrong. It could be this quarter. But yeah, she had an article printed in 2600 Magazine, and it's really neat. So check that out. And then she wrote me mentioning that she heard a comment written by me to Off the Wall, which of course is Emmanuel Goldstein's radio show. I guess not really so much a 2600 production. It's more of like his radio show. So there's Off the Hook, which is the 2600 radio show, and then there's Off the Wall, which is sort of his. And it's basically like a half an hour of him ranting about one thing or another, it seems. But he does it really stylishly. He does it really well. I like it a lot. And I wrote in to him about a comment that he'd made on his show, and he read my letter out on the air and responded to it in detail, really. I guess we're going to agree to disagree on this one, because I think he's wrong and he thinks I'm wrong, so much for that. But it's a good show, and you should listen to it, and I was happy to hear that he actually read the letter on air, because that's always kind of neat, you know, to have your stuff responded to, I guess. I mean, I would have taken an email just as well, but he decided to use it on air, which was nifty. And last but not least, someone literally, and I'm not making this up, someone literally emailed me with a Windows virus question. And they asked me, or they told me that it looks like their friend's computer was infected, and that they did some things. I guess sounds like they created a generic user. I mean, first of all, I didn't even know there were different users really in Windows for a long time, but apparently there are now. And so they created like a generic user to get around this virus or something. I don't really know. I don't really understand how that would get around a virus, but I guess it removed the immediate problem of like the inconvenience of having the virus eat that user's data. So they created a new user without any data for the worm to eat or something, and they were running that for a couple of days, and then finally they rebooted, or they switched back over to the other user, and all their data was gone. Talking to me about this, I guess maybe it was for moral support, because I really had nothing to tell them. I mean, I understand that there are antivirus programs for Windows, but I understand that you have to have them updated frequently, and I understand that you have to probably, I don't know, be on top of that stuff or something. And so I told them that it sounded like probably, you know, their data had been destroyed by a virus, and they responded kind of badly, you know, like it was a really, I don't think they'd expected to hear that. So it was really a bummer. It was really, it was not cool to hear, or to experience. It was like, I almost felt like I got the virus, you know? I mean, it felt really bad when they emailed back and kind of like clearly understood that all of their data was now gone. I mean, if that's not enough to make people stop using Windows, I don't know what would be. I mean, that is insane. for that kind of damage to be done just because they probably went to some online game site, downloaded the wrong little game or something like that. You know, I mean, it's just really, really bad. So it's a bummer. And yeah, I can't see myself ever recommending Windows to anyone. And frankly, I can't see myself recommending Apple to anyone either. But Windows certainly, because that is just too much. That's really bad that a system would have that kind of problem. Very, very painful experience. Even though it was secondhand, it was not fun. So yeah, that's a good reason to use Linux, I guess. So, the show is now over. So, move along. Just go to the next podcast now. It's over. This has been The Bad Apples. I'm Klaatu, and the site is klaatu.hackerpublicradio.org. My email is klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. And I'm on Jabber, at notklaatu@jabber.org. And I'm on IRC typically as NotKlaatu in the channel, on Freenode in the channel Linux Cranks, you know, a lot of Linux links, Slacker Media, Slackware, Linux Outlaws, Linux Basement, and all the others. So say hi to me if you see me there. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Every man, woman, and child in America could go riding at the same time, and if we wanted to, we could all ride in the front seat.